Lester Brown, Environmentalist Emeritus, author of over a dozen books and founder of the Earth Policy Institute, discusses his latest book, Plan B, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. This talk was delivered at University of California, Santa Barbara on February 21st, 2004. Lester Brown.
I wish you could be up here and see what a full auditorium looks like. This is a real welcome, one that I appreciate. Thank you for the introduction, Bob. I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, "I appreciate the truth, but I much prefer flattery." Thank you. You were mentioning some of the recent books. I remember some years ago now, the late Senator Paul Simon of Illinois was introducing me, and he was holding up the latest book I had written. And he said, "Lester's written the sort of book that once you put it down, you can't pick it up again." I have a friend in Washington who is an amateur masseuse, and she once told me that she could put a person to sleep in 15 minutes. And I said, "Well, I don't want to in any way demean your skills, but in 15 minutes, I can put a whole room full of people to sleep." The mayor of Trondheim, Norway, was giving an after-dinner talk a couple of years ago, and like many politicians, he tended to go on. And finally, even he realized he'd been talking for a pretty long time, so he went to check his watch and realized he didn't have a watch, and he turned to the front row and says, "Does anyone have a watch?" And the voice in the back said, "What you need is a calendar." So get out your calendars. Environmentalists who have been working on environmental issues for many years, including many of you in this room, have been saying for some time that if the environmental trends of the last few decades continue, that eventually we will be in trouble. What was not certain is what form the trouble would take and when it would come. I now think it's going to come on the food front and within the next year or two. Not 20 or 30 years from now. I think the wake-up call on the environmental front is imminent. And I think the first global economic indicator that will reflect this is food prices. I'd like to talk about some of the reasons why I think this is the case, and then go to Plan B, which is what we need to be doing in response to this possibility. There has been a remarkable loss of momentum in efforts to expand world grain production. The last time there was a substantial increase was during the 1994-96 period. That was a period when the Chinese raised the support price of grain by 42% in order to try to maintain food self-sufficiency. It was a time when the U.S., seeing the mounting pressure on the world's agricultural resources, dismantled the commodity set-aside program. That was a program where the Department of Agriculture paid farmers to hold a certain percentage of their land out of production each year in order to be eligible for price support programs. And sometimes that would be 5% of the land, sometimes 15%, depending on the world supply-demand balance at that particular time. But that's been dismantled now. We don't have that to fall back on. Farmers have long since returned that to production. The big jump came in 94-96, and no growth since then. And for a few years, that was not a problem because we were producing more than we were consuming. It was excess production. But the last 4 years, In each of the last 4 years, world grain production has fallen short of consumption. In the year 2000, it fell short by 16 million tons, and then it was 29 million tons. In 2002, it was 93 million tons, and last year, the world's farmers fell short by 105 million tons. Now, production, or let me put it this way, consumption can exceed production only when you have stocks to draw down. And during these 4 years, particularly the last 2 years, with roughly 100 million ton shortfalls in each year, world grain stocks have been drawn down now to the lowest level in 30 years. The last time they were at this level, some of you will remember, was in 1972-74. 1972 was when the Soviets had a poor grain harvest, and they secretly cornered the world wheat market before anyone knew what they were doing. And that, plus a poor harvest worldwide the following year, led to a doubling of wheat and rice prices. Now the big challenge we face and the big question is, can the world's farmers this year close the gap, which is actually more than 105 million tons now, because we need 15 million more tons to feed the 70 million people being added this year. So the question is, can the world's farmers increase production by 120 million tons to keep up with the growth in demand? Now, this will not permit any rebuilding of stocks, which are in a very precarious situation right now, but it would avoid a further decline. I think the chances of the farmers closing the gap this year, the chances are probably less than 1 in 10. I think we're going to face another shortfall. The only question is how large will it be and what will the effect be? Now, there are a number of reasons for this. There are the traditional reasons, such as a shrinking backlog of unused agricultural technology. There are a number of countries in the world now where farmers would like more advanced technologies to expand their production, but the technologies are no longer there. Rice growers in Japan, wheat growers in the United States, for example. Yields have been essentially flat now for quite a few years. A second reason why it's difficult for farmers is the cumulative effect of soil erosion. Soil erosion is a very gradual thing in much of the world, but it is slowly undermining land productivity. A third factor is the loss of cropland to non-farm uses. In almost every country in the world, cropland is being converted to residential construction, sprawl in some countries such as this, factory construction, roads and highways. The rule of thumb for paving for automobiles is that for every 10 cars added to the fleet, you have to pave another acre of land, roughly another football field. In China, which last year sold 2 million cars and was quite pleased at the expansion of the automobile industry, that means they had to pave streets, highways, parking lots. They had to pave roughly 200,000 football fields. If you can sort of visualize, I mean, how can you visualize 200,000 football fields? But it's a lot of land being paved over each year. So the amount of productive land that's available is slowly shrinking. So we're looking at these, but we now face two new challenges. The world's farmers are facing a loss of irrigation water because of falling water tables, and they're facing higher temperatures, which are beginning to take the edge off of harvests in some countries. Falling water tables and rising temperatures. These are new. The capacity to overpump aquifers, to overpump underground water, is historically very recent. It's only with the advent of diesel and powerful electrically driven pumps over the last half century or so that we've had this capacity. And the interesting thing is that half the world's people, more than half, now live in countries where water tables are falling, wells are going dry as aquifers are depleted. There are two sort of scary things about this. One is the simultaneity. It's happening in so many countries at the same time. And the other is the sort of exponential nature of the fall. if you can sort of visualize a line that represents the sustainable yield of an aquifer, you can pump up to that level with no problem because the water you take out is replenished by precipitation. But if you go above the sustainable yield, and if you look at a water demand curve, it sort of looks like this. It looks like a population growth curve, except it's steeper, because while population was doubling worldwide over the last half century, water use was tripling. So we're looking at a steep curve. And once the demand curve, once the demand exceeds the sustainable yield, then each year the gap between the demand and sustainable yield gets bigger. And so if you can visualize the underground water table, which after the lines cross, drops just a little bit, each year the drop is bigger than the year before. So it's exponential, but it's underground and invisible. And I think we haven't fully realized yet what's happening. Among the countries where water tables are falling are the big three grain producers, China, India, and the United States, three countries that account for almost half of the world's grain harvest. In China, water tables are falling throughout the northern half of the country, literally everywhere, including under the North China Plain, where they're falling by 3 to 10 feet per year. 10 feet is equal to a story on a building, if you want to sort of visualize that. 3 to 10 feet per year. And the North China Plain is where accounts for half of China's wheat production and a fifth of its corn production. The loss of irrigation water there is beginning to squeeze agriculture. And farmers are, in effect, faced with a double squeeze because not only are they affected by the shrinkage in the supply as more and more wells go dry, but they are also affected by the growing demand in cities. So farmers are getting a shrinking share of a shrinking supply. We have a similar situation in India, where water tables are now falling in most states, including the Punjab, which is the breadbasket of India. In this country, water tables are falling throughout the southern Great Plains. I flew into Denver on Monday afternoon, going to the University of Denver and University of Colorado at Boulder. And as you fly in, those of you who have made that flight, you see these circles, these green, in the summertime, green circles in the last few hundred miles coming in western Kansas and eastern Colorado. In the center of each of those circles is a well and a pump. And they are drawing water from the Ogallala Aquifer, which is essentially a fossil aquifer. It means it's not recharged. The water tables are falling, and a lot of farmers are losing their irrigation water as the wells go dry. So water shortages are becoming a major issue. And I said to someone last night, I think what we need is another Malthus. When Thomas Malthus wrote his famous treatise in, I think it was 1798, he sort of indelibly imprinted on our consciousness the importance of the population-food relationship. We now need someone to do that for population and water. In some ways, water is more fundamental than food, not only because we need it in its own right, but because it is now the key to expanding world food production. It's water shortages, not land shortages, that are the primary constraint on efforts to expand food production. One of the interesting things about the current time is that water shortages are beginning to cross national boundaries via the international grain trade. The fastest growing grain import region in the world is North Africa and the Middle East. That's Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and the Middle East through Iran. Every country in that region is pushing up against the limits of their water supplies. As they do so, they satisfy the growing demand for water in cities by taking irrigation water from agriculture. They then import grain to offset the loss of productive capacity. And the reason for this is that when you import a ton of grain, you are, in effect, importing 1,000 tons of water. It takes 1,000 tons of water to produce 1 ton of grain. To put it in personal terms, we drink, on average, about 4 liters of water a day in one form or another, as water, as coffee, or juice, or beer or pop or what have you. 4 liters a day. The food we consume each day requires 2,000 liters to produce, or 500 times as much. The food-water linkage is an important one, and I don't think we've yet quite grasped the dimensions and the seriousness of this relationship. The water required to produce the grain imported into North Africa and the Middle East last year was roughly equal to the annual flow of the Nile River. So if you want to visualize the size of the water deficit in the Middle East, it's equal to another Nile River flowing into the region in the form of imported grain. It has often been said in recent years that future wars in the Middle East will more likely be fought over water than over oil. And that could be, but it's not easy to win a water war. And what in fact is happening is that the competition for water is taking place in world grain markets. Trading in grain futures now is, in a sense, trading in water futures. So spreading water scarcity is now beginning to affect world food security. The second issue, the second new trend that's affecting the food prospect, is rising temperatures. Crop ecologists at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines and at the Agricultural Research Service in the U.S. Department of Agriculture are focusing on the, in their research, are focusing on the precise relationship between temperature and crop yields. And what they are discovering is that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature during the growing season, there is a 10% decline in grain yields. And this holds for wheat, rice, and corn. The most vulnerable period is the fertilization period, the period when the flower on the rice plant, for example, or the wheat plant, tiny flowers on the spike convert into grain kernels. I can remember the data from one of the research projects in the Philippines looking at rice. In this research project, they pointed out that at 93 degrees Fahrenheit, you get almost 100% fertilization. That is, every one of the tiny flowers on the spikelet converts into a kernel of rice. At 104 degrees Fahrenheit, you get essentially zero fertilization and a total crop failure. So the difference, that 11 degree Fahrenheit difference between 93 and 104 degrees, is in food security terms an enormous difference. Some of you may have seen the article in Fortune magazine the other day, citing the other day, it's been a few weeks ago now, citing the, and if you want to look it up, the author is David Stipp, S-T-I-P-P. And this article cited a Department of Defense security study on climate change. And the study basically said climate change could dwarf the other threats to security that we are now concerning ourselves with. We used to say that the 16 warmest years on record have occurred since 1980, and that's still true. But more importantly, the 4 warmest years on record have now come in the last 6 years, and 3 of them during these last 4 years when we've had substantial shortfalls. 2 years ago, in 2002, intense heat and drought shrunk the grain harvests of India and the United States. Last year, it was Europe that bore the brunt of intense heat in the summer. You may remember the heat wave in August that claimed 14,800 lives in France. That's several times the number we lost when the World Trade Towers went down. But that heat wave that took about 35,000 lives in Europe altogether, and these are official numbers, that heat wave from reduced grain harvest from France all the way through the Ukraine. Every country in that region suffered at least some decline in harvests, and some countries the declines were substantial. But rising temperatures are now becoming a factor that we have to take into account in thinking about future food security, along with falling water tables. And the one point I didn't mention about water is that overpumping to expand food production today almost guarantees a future drop in food production when the aquifer is depleted. I mention this because most of the agricultural economists who are doing the supply and demand projections at USDA or FAO in Rome do not understand hydrology very well and the effect that, I mean, they sort of know there's a water problem, but they don't know quite how to incorporate it into the projections. I think it's a serious omission. Now, if I were to pick an event that will sort of trigger a triggering event, if you will, the source of the wake-up call, it would be when China turns to the world market for massive imports of grain. China's grain production in 1950 totaled about 90 million tons. By 1998, it had increased to 392 million tons. A major achievement, one of the great economic achievements of the last half century. 90 to 392. During the 5 years since then, it has dropped to 322 million tons, a drop of 70 million tons. To put that in perspective, that's larger than the grain harvest of Canada, for example. It also exceeds the exports of Canada, Australia, and Argentina combined. There are several reasons why China's grain production is falling. One is expanding deserts. The Gobi Desert, according to Chinese official data, is expanding about 4,000 square miles a year. If you can envisage 40 miles by 100 miles, 4,000 square miles per year. China is also losing land to non-farm uses. I mentioned 2 million cars and paving over 200,000, the equivalent of 200,000 football fields to accommodate the growing use of the automobile. Another trend is clearly the loss of water. A lot of farmers are watching their land productivity drop as they go from irrigated agriculture to dry land farming because their well has gone dry. Still another, in China, there are 200 million farms. They average about an acre and a half each. That's not much larger than a building lot in the suburbs of an American city. In order to try to raise their incomes, many are switching to higher value crops, vegetables and fruits, a lot of multiple cropping of vegetables. It's a very intensive production, but it takes advantage of their labor and maximizes the income from the land. But that also is shrinking the grain area. Still another thing, in the more prosperous coastal provinces, there's been a loss of young people. And so the double cropping of wheat and corn, which is quite common in the North China Plain, for example, winter wheat ripens in mid-June or so, maybe a little later. And once it's ripe, you have to harvest it quickly and then prepare the seed bed to get the corn in so it can mature before the frost comes in the fall. And when you lose labor, you no longer have enough labor to do this quickly. And if you can't do it quickly, then you can't do it at all. So this is also shrinking the grain area in China. The grain area in China in the last 5 years has shrunk from 90 million hectares to 77 million hectares, and it's continuing to drop. Now, China has been covering this decline in its grain production by drawing down its once massive stocks of grain. Its grain stocks in the last 5 years have dropped from roughly 300 million tons to 100 million tons. And you can't go to zero. You have to have enough grain in the system to operate it. Within the next year, I think China's going to be forced into the world market to import 30, 40, 50 million tons of grain. Incidentally, there is a Chinese wheat delegation in this country now. They arrived last Sunday, and on Wednesday, I saw the news reports that they had bought a million tons of grain already, and they were looking to buy maybe another million more tons before they left this weekend. When China comes into the world market for grain on this scale, it will dwarf anything that any other country is doing. Everything in China is big. I remember when I was working on the book, Who Will Feed China, almost 10 years ago now, and I was calculating the amount of grain needed if each Chinese consumed another egg or if each Chinese drank another bottle of beer or what have you. And I told my colleagues, the thing you learn when you're working on China is a basic sort of mathematical truth, which is a billion times anything is a lot. And I mean, I've worked, you know, for a long time on world agriculture, having joined the Department of Agriculture when Eisenhower was still president, working in the Foreign Agricultural Service. But never before had I really worked on a country like China and the enormous scale of everything there. When China comes into the world market, it will necessarily come to the United States. This will create a fascinating geopolitical situation. What we will soon be looking at is 1.3 billion Chinese consumers who have a $100 billion annual trade surplus with the United States. $100 billion, by the way, is enough to buy the U.S. grain harvest, the entire U.S. grain harvest, twice. So the question is not, do they have the purchasing power? They do. And what we're likely will see is 1.3 billion Chinese competing with us for our grain, driving up our food prices. Now, if something like this had happened 30 years ago, we would have said, get lost. We would not have tolerated anything like that. But today, we have a stake in a politically stable China. It is, after all, the Chinese economy that is the engine of the Asian economy today, that's sort of powering the Asian economy. Japan, the Japanese economy, has been dead in the water for more than a decade now. Beyond that, the Chinese economy is the only large economy in the world that's had a full head of steam in recent years. So the entire world is, in a sense, dependent on China. And what I think we will see within the next year or two is two or three ships being loaded every day in this country with grain, wheat, mostly wheat or corn, headed for China. There will be a long line of ships crossing the Pacific. Now, managing that flow of grain will not be easy, considering the interests of the two countries at the same time. I think it's going to be a real challenge. I think what the Chinese will realize is that for the first time in their history, they will be heavily dependent on the outside world for part of their food supply. And what we will realize is that, like it or not, we're going to be sharing our food with the Chinese. Now, one of the indirect effects of this, I've been doing it in terms of China and the U.S., but one of the indirect effects of China moving into the world market on this scale is it's almost certainly going to drive up grain prices. Incidentally, wheat, rice, and corn prices are up 20 to 30% over what they were a year ago. Looking at May futures, for example, they've gone up a lot in recent months. Now, if we have another shortfall this year, large grain shortfall, then these 20 to 30% increases in grain prices we've seen will just be the sort of the tremors before the quake. And we'll see something far more dramatic. Now, the risk here is, and the Department of Defense, in fact, the National Intelligence Council did a study on this several years ago. But the risk is that higher grain prices, particularly if there are dramatic rises, a doubling, for example, which is entirely possible, could destabilize governments in low-income countries that import a large part of their grain supply. That political instability could disrupt global economic progress, could affect the Nikkei index in Japan, the Dow Jones 500 in this country. And what we would suddenly realize is that what began as environmental trends, and particularly the two new ones, falling water tables and rising temperatures, have worked their way through the system, affecting the grain harvest, affecting food prices, affecting political stability, affecting the global economy. At that point, it might become clear to us that we can no longer continue to neglect environmental trends, the trends of environmental degradation. We're going to have to deal with them. And as I was talking with Walter Cohn at lunch today, what we have to hope is that there's enough of a jolt to wake us up, but not such a great jolt that it would lead to a collapse of the system. And this is the real challenge that we're facing. Some things we can measure with great precision, others much less so. I've talked about temperature. We now measure temperature. We measure atmospheric CO2 levels to the tenth of a part per million. We can measure changes from year to year with great precision. Other things we cannot measure so precisely, like the loss of topsoil. And we have to distinguish between the things that we know with great precision and those that we don't. There was a family in Boston some time back that was visiting a museum there. And in the museum was a skeleton of a dinosaur. And they were looking at the dinosaur, and they were trying to figure out the dinosaur's age, but there was nothing in the legend to explain that. So the building engineer came through, and they stopped him and said, "Sir, can you tell us how old this dinosaur is?" And he said, "Yes. This dinosaur is 65 million and 12 years old." And they said, "Wow, how do you know that?" He said, "When I came to work here 12 years ago, they..." In science, that's known as the law of misplaced precision. When the wake-up call comes, I think it means we're going to have to turn to Plan B. Plan A, business as usual, is not going to take us where we want to go. And it's going to be one of the most fundamental shifts, I think, one of those what someone once called a hinge point in human history. And once you cross these points, beyond them, everything changes and is different and appears differently than it did before. And I think we're on the edge of that kind of a change. In thinking about Plan B, there was a cartoon in the New York Times a couple of months ago, and it showed a board table, a long board table, and sitting on the side facing the cartoonist, I suppose, who was sketching it, was a long row of generals. And at the end, there was a general who was holding up a document, and the document said, "Iraq, Plan B." And one of the generals turned to the other and he said, "Was there a Plan A?" Well, that, I think, is sort of where we are now in looking at these issues. There is no Plan A unless we consider business as usual. I'd like to talk about three of the key components, talk briefly about three of the key components of Plan B. One is to stabilize population sooner rather than later. The other is a global full-court press to raise water productivity. And the third is almost a crash effort to cut carbon emissions and stabilize climate. With population, as most of you know, the UN has three sets of projections. It has a low projection, and on the low projection, We go from our current 6.3 billion to something like 7.4 billion in 2042, and then population begins to decline. In the median projection, which is the one we're on now, we go from 6.3 to, I think, about 10.4, somewhere around 2080, then that one peaks and begins to decline. And then the high goes to 11.8 or 12 or so at the end of the century, or maybe beyond, before peaking and beginning to decline. I think the challenge for us is try to move from the medium trajectory to the low trajectory. And that's going to require a real effort. It's going to require that we fill the family planning gap. As you know, at the moment, we have been withholding $34 million of U.S. financial support for the UN Population Fund. I think that's inexcusable. There are 130 million women in the world who want to limit the size of their families. They don't have to be convinced of anything. They want to limit the size of the families. They understand the need and the advantages of doing so. But they do not have access to family planning services. We need to fill that family planning gap. The second thing we need to do is to create the social conditions that will facilitate the shift to smaller families. That means education, especially of girls. The more education women have, the more options they have, and the fewer children they have. And that's a relationship that holds in every society for which we have data. We need basic health care to reduce infant mortality in those countries where it is still quite high. When infant mortality is high, couples are reluctant to reduce the number of children for fear of losing some. Jeffrey Sachs, the economist, has been working with WHO to sketch out a strategy, and they've actually looked at what it would take to immunize all children against infectious diseases. And second, to provide at least clinic-level village health care throughout the developing world. And the price tag on this is something like $29 billion a year above current expenditures. And if you include education, and I also include in this effort the need to provide school lunches for the poorest of the poor countries. And that's one to get kids in school. Parents will send them to school so they can get at least one meal a day. And secondly, so they can have enough food that they can actually learn and concentrate. Now, you put all these together, healthcare, family planning, and creating the social conditions, including school lunch, and it comes out to about $62 billion a year of additional expenditures. Now, that sounds like quite a bit, but it's less than $87 billion. Which is what we're spending on one country. The second thing is raising water productivity. When I joined the Department of Agriculture back in the 50s, we were at that time beginning to look toward the end of the century, and we saw enormous growth in population, but little new land to bring under the plow even then. And what we realized was that we had to get serious about raising land productivity in a systematic, sustained manner, which no one had done before with the exception of Japan. Japan was the only country that before World War II was actually raising its grain yields, in this case, rice, in a very systematic way. And that meant raising land productivity meant spending money on agricultural research. We invested heavily in agricultural research. It meant changing price policies, food price policies, in a lot of countries. A lot of countries, India, for example, had a ceiling price policy for wheat and for rice. They limited prices in order to satisfy the interests of the urban elites. But what that did was it depressed and discouraged agricultural development because the prices were so low that farmers could not profitably invest in measures to raise their land productivity. So I was personally involved in 1965 in negotiating with the Indians, who just had a monsoon failure, and were heavily dependent on the U.S. Indeed, we shipped a fifth of our wheat crop to India that year to stave off famine. But in exchange for that, we negotiated some agricultural reforms. And one was to replace a ceiling price policy with a support price policy to encourage farmers to invest and raise their land productivity. So that's that kind of thing is what we need to be doing now with water. Those efforts, by the way, succeeded in nearly tripling world grain land productivity between 1950 and 2000. We now need to do that with water, with irrigation practices, with more efficient crops, raising the price of water. In many places in the world, the price of water is a carryover from decades ago when water was abundant. It is no longer abundant, but in many places, it is still priced as though it was an abundant resource rather than a scarce one. So we need to engage that issue, and I won't go into more detail on water. The third thing we need to do is stabilize climate, and we may want to do it quickly. I mentioned the possibility that rising temperatures can shrink harvests and raise food prices. If it becomes apparent that that is the case, we will suddenly have a major new lobby for cutting carbon emissions and stabilizing climate, namely consumers. That's the encouraging thing. There's a growing, I think, sense of anxiety about climate in the public, not necessarily in official Washington, but in the rest of the world. And it's based on a number of things. In the last several months, there have been a number of stories on ice melting in the Arctic possibly leading to a shift in the Gulf Current. As you know, the Gulf Current goes up the east coast of the United States, very warm water, east coast of the United States, eastern Canada, and then turns east across the Atlantic, just south of Greenland, comes down the western coast of Europe and then Africa. And that carries heat. That's why Western Europe's climate is quite mild compared either with the Canadian climate or the climate in Siberia, which are at essentially the same latitude. But if that current is disrupted, and that's a distinct possibility, and it takes a shortcut going across and just goes across to Africa and leaves out the North Atlantic, then Europe's climate, Western Europe's climate, could be much more like that of Siberia than the climate it has today. Or consider the map that the World Bank has published of Bangladesh with a one meter rise in sea level, which is entirely within range during this century. And what they've pointed out is that Bangladesh would lose half of its rice land, and 40 million people would be displaced. Where do you relocate 40 million people in a country that's already one of the world's most densely populated? How many countries outside Bangladesh? How many other countries would take even a million of those rising sea level refugees? I mention these two examples, I can mention many more, simply to point out that we may soon decide that the cost of climate change may be unacceptably high, and one that we do not want to take, and that we will change course and move toward climate stability. Now, the exciting thing is that we can do this. We have the technologies now to do it. I mean, for example, if we were to be convinced, the world, that we needed to move quickly to stabilize climate and cut carbon emissions, and I suggest cutting carbon emissions in half by 2015. Now, in the city where I come from, Washington, cutting carbon emissions 7% by 2012, the Kyoto Protocol goal, is thought, you know, that it will damage the economy, and we just don't want to do it. But consider, for example, if we decided that we wanted to replace the old-fashioned incandescent light bulbs. I can't tell what we have here, but in much of the world, we still have incandescent light bulbs in use. Replace them with the new compact fluorescents, which use less than a third as much electricity. If we decided worldwide we're going to do that, it's not a big deal. We could close literally hundreds of coal-fired power plants and sharply reduce carbon emissions. Now, the interesting thing is that making the shift from incandescence to compact fluorescence, that investment will yield about 30% a year. So it's a win-win situation. We cut carbon emissions and make money at the same time. Or consider if we decided in this country to raise the fuel efficiency of our automobile fleet by, say, 2010 to the level of last year's Toyota Prius. This is a technology already on the market. It would mean we could cut our gasoline use in half. No change in the number of automobiles, no change in miles driven, just doing it with a more efficient, newer technology. Entirely doable. Let me turn to the supply side for a minute. There are many renewable sources of energy: wind, solar, solar thermal, solar voltaic, geothermal, biomass, etc. I'd like to talk about one, which is wind. And because I think it's the first renewable source where the technology and the costs are falling into place for some extraordinary growth. You probably know that worldwide wind energy has been growing about 30% a year. As of the end, and it's been growing even faster in Europe. As of the end of December, 36 million Europeans were getting their residential electricity from wind energy. They are projecting that by 2020, it will be 195 million Europeans getting their electricity from wind. 16 years from now, 195 million is half of Europe's population. Entirely doable. There are six reasons why I think wind is going to be the centerpiece of the new energy economy. It's abundant, cheap, inexhaustible, widely distributed, clean, and climate benign. No other energy source has all those attributes. Abundant. Some of you may remember that in 1992, the U.S. Department of Energy did a national wind resource inventory. And in this assessment, they pointed out that three of the 50 states, North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas, have enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national electricity needs. Now, when that came out, a lot of people said, wow, because most people didn't think wind was a huge resource. They thought it was sort of a fringe energy resource. But it's huge. In retrospect, we now know that that was a gross underestimate because it was based on the wind turbine technologies of 1992. Advances in wind turbine design since then have reduced the wind speed at which turbines will operate. They have increased the efficiency with which wind is converted into electricity. And because they are taller, they harvest a much larger wind regime. I would guess in 1992, the average wind turbine was maybe 120 feet tall. Today, the new turbines going in are more like 300 feet tall. So we're harvesting much more wind than we used to. Whereas the Department of Energy could say in 1992 that these three states have enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national electricity needs, we can now probably say that these three states have enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national energy needs. Wind is a huge resource. I had a phone call from my son some time back. He was driving in West Texas on one of the interstates. It might have been I-10, I'm not sure. But he came across one of the new wind farms in Texas. Texas has been the fastest growing part of the country for wind energy in the last few years. And he said it was interesting because you could see the rows of wind turbines receding toward the horizon. This is a huge wind farm. And he said interspersed among the rows of wind turbines were oil wells. The wind turbines were turning, the oil wells were pumping. And he said it was the past and the future meeting. And he said he was looking at the energy transition from fossil fuels to renewable sources of energy. And he was frustrated because he didn't have his camera. But I said, you know, if you go back 30 years from now, the wind turbines will still be turning, but the oil wells will probably not be pumping. I had a visit recently from my good friend Ken Lay. I think Ken wanted someone to talk to, but anyhow, I've been on programs for, you know, a dozen years with Ken, with dealing with energy and climate and so forth. But one of the things he did when he was CEO at Enron was to buy two wind companies. One was Zond here in California, the Jim Dielson, who funded the Dielson Chair in Environmental Studies that Jim Dielson started, sold it to Enron, and Enron also bought a wind company in Europe. And they put these together to make up Enron Wind. This was one of the genuinely successful pieces of the Enron complex. The reason he did this, incidentally, this was sold to GE for $385 million and is now GE Wind. But the reason he did this, and he was a visionary, maybe too much of one, but the reason he did it was because he realized that one day the gas fields in Texas would be exhausted. But they had the infrastructure, the pipelines going into the Northeast, the Midwest, one going all the way to California. And what he planned to do was to build wind farms, use the electricity from wind to electrolyze water and produce hydrogen, and use that same infrastructure to distribute hydrogen. Now, Ken is no longer at Enron. Enron may not exist in any meaningful way today, but the natural gas will be depleted, the infrastructure is still there, and the wind is still blowing in Texas. Someone is going to put that together. I mean, it's so obvious. It's going to come. Wind is cheap. When wind electric generation started here in the early 80s, wind-generated electricity cost about 38 cents a kilowatt hour in the early days. It has now dropped to 4 cents. There have been some long-term supply contracts signed at 3 cents a kilowatt hour, and the projections are, both by the Europeans and by Americans, that by 2010, in many parts of the world, it's going to be 2 cents or less. That's cheap electricity. Once you get that, then you can electrolyze water to produce hydrogen. Hydrogen is not only the fuel source from new fuel cell engines that it requires making, that every automobile manufacturer is working on, but this is longer term. It's going to take a little while to get the fuel cells on the road in large numbers. But we have another option in the short run if we want to exercise it, and that is to convert the existing fleet of automobiles from gasoline to hydrogen. There are conversion kits to do this. It's not that difficult. Any engine that burns gasoline can also burn hydrogen. If you've been in Tokyo and ridden in a taxi cab, if you look when you put your bags in the trunk, you'll see two canisters behind the back seat at the back of the trunk. And they contain methane. I think today all the taxis in Tokyo burn methane because it's clean burning. And it cuts air pollution. Now the question is, how do we make this shift, and how do we do it quickly? I think the key is restructuring the tax system. We need to get the market to tell the ecological truth. As decision makers, we as consumers, corporate planners, government policymakers, investment bankers, we all take our cues from the market. From the signals, from the price signals that the market gives us. That's the principal factor shaping our decisions. But if the market is giving us the wrong signals, then we are making poor decisions. And in many cases, wrong decisions. Let me give an example. Almost 2 years ago, the Center for Disease Control published a study on the social costs of cigarette smoking in the United States. And they looked at two costs, the cost of treating smoking-related illnesses and the cost of lost worker productivity from those illnesses. Taking into account just those two costs, they didn't allow anything for premature loss of life or what have you, They concluded that the cost to society of smoking a pack of cigarettes is $7.18 per pack. $7.18. Now, this is not the cost of growing the tobacco, manufacturing the cigarettes. This is the cost to society. These costs are real. They are borne by someone, maybe the smoker, maybe the employer, maybe taxpayers underwriting the cost of Medicare. Someone pays those costs. Now, the interesting question is, does it cost more? Is the cost to society of burning a gallon of gasoline more or less than that of smoking a pack of cigarettes? And the answer is, we don't know because we haven't done the calculations. And they're more difficult. With smoking, you use historical epidemiological data and so forth, and very good data. This is sort of a model study that the CDC has done. But with burning a gallon of gasoline, we have to look at not only increased respiratory illnesses and damage to mass terrain, but climate change. And I talked about some of the changes that can be so massively costly and disruptive. But that's what we need to do. And once we figure out what those costs are, then we need to include them in the price. And you do that by restructuring the tax system, lowering income taxes, and offsetting that with an increase in, say, a carbon tax. No change in the level of taxation, just restructuring the tax system to get the market to be more honest and include all the costs of burning a gallon of gasoline, not just the cost of getting the oil out of the ground and refining it into gasoline. Oystein Dalley, who at one time, in fact for many years, was Exxon's vice president for Norway and the North Sea. He's now retired, in fact recently replaced me as the chairman of the board at the World Watch Institute. But Oystein said, socialism collapsed because it did not allow the market to tell the economic truth. Capitalism may collapse because it does not allow the market to tell the ecological truth. That's in Plan B, that quote, if you're interested in it. And then I looked at the budget costs. And I looked at our defense budget when I was working on Plan B and went back to 2002 defense budget before Iraq. It was $343 billion. $343 billion is more than all of our allies, all of our NATO allies, plus Russia, plus China, spent for military purposes. U.S. military expenditures exceeded that of all of our allies, plus Russia, plus China, and you can throw in the evil axis as well if you want. Retired Navy Admiral Eugene Carroll said of this, "For 50 years we were in an arms race with the Soviet Union. Now we are in an arms race with ourselves." The interesting question is, if we look at the defense budget and the State Department budget, AID, and look at it as a foreign policy budget, you know, the 343 for military, and there's about another 17 maybe for aid and so forth. I mean, it's really very small. It comes to 360 altogether for that year. But what if we asked ourselves, how do we optimize U.S. security in the world? How would we allocate that budget? And my guess is that we would allocate it, if we start with that question, we would allocate it very differently than we do at present. The other thing I did as I was researching and getting ready to write Plan B was to think about how quickly we can change we have to. And to get a feel for this, I went back and read some of the economic history of World War II. And in particular, I read President Roosevelt's State of the Union Address, January 6, 1942. This is 1 month after December 7th, 1941. And it was in this address that he laid out the arms production goals for the country. He said, "We're going to produce 45,000 tanks, 60,000 planes, 20,000 artillery guns, 2 million tons of shipping. We needed an enormous amount of shipping because we're suddenly fighting two land wars on the far side of two oceans. I mean, no one had ever seen arms production goals on this scale before. This was entirely beyond what anyone had ever thought of or done. But what Roosevelt and his colleagues realized was that the largest concentration of industrial power in the world at that time was the U.S. automobile industry. Because even during the Depression, we were making 3 or 4 million cars a year. So after his State of the Union address, he called in the leaders of the industry and said, because you guys control such a large share of the country's industrial capacity, we're going to depend heavily on you to reach these arms production goals. And they said, well, Mr. President, we're going to do everything we can, but it's going to be a real stretch producing all these cars and arms at the same time. He said, you don't understand. We're going to ban the sale of private automobiles in the United States. I mean, it's hard to imagine that now. That's exactly what happened. From the beginning of April 1942 until the end of 1944, there were no cars produced in the United States. The entire automobile industry was mobilized for arms production, and it didn't take decades. It didn't take years. It was done in a matter of months. I mean, Chrysler went very quickly from manufacturing cars to manufacturing tanks. And the automobile industry was manufacturing armored personnel carriers, aircraft engines, I mean, you name it. And we exceeded every one of those goals. The point is, it's doable. We can change quickly if it becomes important to us to do so. My concluding point is this. On September 11th, 2001, I was in New York City to give a luncheon talk at the New York Times and introduce my then new book, Eco-Economy, Building an Economy for the Earth. Needless to say, that lunch never occurred. But what it has sort of reminded me of, as I've thought about it, is that since then, the time and energy of political leaders, or let me put it this way, political leaders and the media have become preoccupied with terrorism. Now, if Osama bin Laden and his colleagues succeed in diverting our attention from the environmental trends that are undermining our future, they may reach their goals for reasons that they never imagined. Thank you very much.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.